Welcome back to the Hemingway List. Whoops. The podcast where we go from Hemingway Zero to Hemingway Hero right here, right now, etc. I'm in the midst, at the precipice of a very, very busy weekend. I've got to do a bunch of Uber driving this weekend because, well, basically I've got to be behind with my bills. So, oops. And also, we've got a couple of, well, I've broken it into shorter chapters, but we've got some podcasting to get through. But the big thing that's really making it the busy weekend is that my band is going into the recording studio this weekend to start tracking drums, which is where I kind of want to be spending most of my time. They've also deemed me the documentarian of the recording process, so I'm doing like a bit of a behind-the-scenes production diary vlog sort of thing. So, I'm going to be spending a whole lot of hours in the recording studio, a whole lot of hours driving, and a few hours podcasting. And it's like, I don't really know where I'm going to fit sleeping in and all that, but anyway. We'll do a little bit of sleeping here and there. I'm also like neck deep in Star Trek Discovery, the new one on Netflix. I've been watching The Orville, which is like my favorite show. And between episodes, I was like, man, I want more Orville. I suppose Star Trek will have to do, so I've been watching a bit of Star Trek. It's pretty good. Anyway, so I've also got some binge TV watching to do. I'm a busy man. What a weird way to start the show. Why am I saying that? Oh, yeah. Just if the podcasts seem a bit slapped together, not tonight's one, but probably tomorrow's night's one, it might just be because I'm in a bit of a rush due to having a very, very busy day. My band, if you're curious, is called Verona Lights, kind of like a new metal, old school dad rock kind of band, I suppose. Verona, like this town in Italy, V-E-R-O-N-A, lights, as in like the things that turn on your roof and light the place up. Yeah, have a look if you want to do a bit of a mosh. Anyway, our next album, our third album, is what we're going to start tracking, and it's actually my first album with the band. So, I don't know, I've been playing in this band for like 2 years, but we haven't really done an album yet, so I'm excited. It's a pretty cool thing. The recording process is my favourite part of being in a band, so, I don't know, I'm real pumped. I'm really happy, so that's going to be my priority for the weekend. Unfortunately, I do have to also spend quite a few hours driving Uber. So, yeah, it just doesn't leave many hours in between all that. Today, anyway, that's completely sidetracked. You don't care about any of that. Today, we are continuing to read Dubliner's Story 15, The Dead. This is going to be part 2 of 3. I've broken it into thirds. But first, we're going to discuss the first part of The Dead. The questions that I asked you guys were these. Gabriel seems to think his audience is beneath the poetry of Robert Browning. What do you think that means? Can anyone elaborate on the setting of this story? What kind of concert is this? Is Joyce showing any sympathy to the lady who is accusing Gabriel of forgetting where he comes from? And extra, what do you think about breaking up the long chapters in this way? I think this project works best with shorter snippets. And the thing I noticed about yesterday's chapter, it was the longest chapter so far that we've done. And I think that includes the whole year of War and Peace as well. I think it was the longest chapter that I've done in 380 or so episodes. And it also elicited the least discussion / comments so far, at least for this year. And I reckon there is a correlation there. I think if we read too much, it makes it hard to comment. So then we get this imbalance where we have a really long reading and a really short discussion, and I think it throws the balance out. I think it's best to, typically it's something like 50-50, isn't it? Like about 15 minutes talking, 15 minutes of reading. I reckon that's a good balance. 10 and 10, 5 and 5, you know, you get the picture. But when it's a 45-minute reading, or like that episode went for over an hour, I reckon we break it up. Swim said the mum fishy said, regarding breaking up the longer chapters, I am in total support. I did read all of The Dead last night in one sitting and found my attention flagging. Arvip said, I read it all too, and would have preferred to break it up. I have something else I'm reading each night and had to push that aside. Can I ask whether there is a list or schedule to refer to if you decide to split up chapters into parts? Swim said the Mum of Fishy said, very good question. It appears the dead has been split up into three parts. See the header and last line. I read ahead of the postings, so if chapters are split in the future, I would like a heads up, please, if possible. If not, I will cope. Right. We don't have a schedule that moves that far forward, only because we only really know what the next book is at any given time. The next book is Wuthering Heights. We'll be starting that in a couple of days. We don't know what the next book is after that, which brings me to another point I need to make. We're going to open up the voting for the fifth book soon, so keep an eye out for that. But the thing is that I haven't read the books that we're reading, and so I don't always know the chapter structures. I don't always know how long the next chapter is until I get there. I will try to, as best I can, give a little heads up a day or two. I have a little flick through the next couple of chapters every now and then and see if there's any long ones coming up. And I'll try to give you a heads up if we're going to break up a chapter. But it is also hard as well, because then I'm not really sure, until I'm reading the chapter, I'm not sure where I'll break it up sometimes. Like this particular one, it doesn't have like big obvious dividers or anything like that in the story to show you like, oh, here's a beat where it would be a good place to take a little pause. So I just had to kind of read until there was a beat in the story where it was like, a new scene kind of thing, or a new section of the story. So I will do my best to try to give you a heads up, but sometimes, yeah, we might have these little slip-ups. But I think overall it runs pretty smoothly. Every now and then you might accidentally read ahead by half a chapter or so, or that kind of thing. But when this all smooths out over the long time this series will go on, I think, like Swim said, the Mum of Fishy said, if it's not possible, I'll cope. It's no massive disaster if we all read a little bit of a different chunk of a story. If you read ahead by a few paragraphs or whatever. We'll have to have a look what maybe the other moderators here can do. Techrific is pretty handy with this kind of thing, and Free Science, who I haven't heard from a little while, but he pulled out some like spreadsheets and was doing all this like data manipulation stuff about the story, so maybe he can come up with something like a chapter length map or something like that. But yeah, we'll look into it. We'll do our best. Arvip said, Gabriel is interesting. He doesn't want to sound ridiculous in his speech. Reading quotes from Robert Browning, feeling his audience belongs to a grade of culture that is different, or maybe inferior. They wouldn't understand poetry, he believes. Gabriel feels he is superior based on his education and teaching at the college, and his worldly fashion and travel and his weekly literary review and his mother with all the brains in the family. Yet I get the feeling he is insecure. It was amusing to see him challenged by Miss Ivers, who was ashamed of him writing for a rag and accused him of being a West Briton. A derogatory remark implying he was too British. And yet she was begging he and his wife to vacation with them in the Aran Islands, and she read one of his literary reviews of Browning and liked it, or so she said. Miss Ivers seemed to see Gabriel for who he was. I don't think I've yet seen him for who he is. Maybe Miss Ivers is right, maybe not, but I do know there's a lot of contention in Ireland about, especially at this time, about being too British. And those who were the first to sort of adapt to English they had a hard time of it. And so I know that there was an ongoing long thing about language there. They had some excellent writers, and the best way to make a career out of writing for them was to write in English, because of, you know, just because of there's so much more of an audience that way, more opportunities. So yeah, there was this weird thing, and I bet it's the same thing for James Joyce, where you're known and loved within your country for writing, yet you don't write in your native tongue. So I can see how that would be a point of contention for Joyce, and I bet he came up against a bit of this very same flack that Gabriel is, and maybe I sort of thought maybe Gabriel is supposed to represent him in some ways. Techrific said, yes, I don't see arrogance in him yet. I see an educated person who comes from the same background as the guests, and especially his aunts, of course, so I get the feeling he doesn't want to embarrass them or himself. He's not ashamed of them, but he doesn't want to over-explain things or have to talk over their heads. I feel he genuinely needs them to appreciate the speech and feel proud of him. That's the motivation. I agree, Miss Ivers sees him for who he is. She's also a teacher at the same uni, and they grew up together as students. The fact that she seems to be part of the revivalists, and he definitely is not, is a source of contention between them. She seems to say that bicycling in Belgium, France, and Germany to keep his languages alive is all well and good, but he has an entire country, Ireland, to rediscover and appreciate, but he hates Ireland, and he's even shocked at his own reaction about it. Could Joyce be putting some of his own feelings into Conroy? I reckon he probably is. Techrific also said, for the folks who don't listen to the podcast, oh, never mind this, Anderstopped Part 1, page 216, Every Man's Library Edition. I suppose this is kind of irrelevant because anyone listening is someone who reads the, listens to the podcast. Anyway, I'll skip that comment. Techrific also said, this made me think of a Merchant Ivory movie. It begins with the hustle and bustle of the Morkans household that are hosting their annual dance. It's around Christmas time and Dublin is cold and snowy. We get an upstairs and a downstairs feeling with the poor Lily having to flail about like a madman to keep the women informed of who has arrived while simultaneously having to open the door and take care of the overcoats of the guests arriving. Very cinematic. The Morkans' house is on Usher Island, and that name brought me to Edgar Allan Poe, and the fact that this story could have been something very different from the one that it turns out to be. It seems to be a happy occasion. Conroy and his wife Greta are much awaited by the Morkans, since Conroy is their favourite nephew. Greta jokes around a little at her husband's expense and is then swiftly taken away by the women. Conroy proceeds to gift Lily with a coin as it's Christmas time. Conroy is left alone with his thoughts. He turns out to be a university teacher and occasional literary columnist, whose main worry at the moment seems to be a speech he's outlined on a piece of paper. He thinks his Robert Browning quote might be too highbrow for his audience and that he'll come across as a pompous intellectual. Joyce has set up the scene nicely in this part, I think. Towards the end of this part, I couldn't help but notice that Miss Ivers mentioned Kathleen Kearney. Surely that must be the daughter from the previous story. I wonder how many years after a mother this is supposed to be. Anyway, a good start to this story. I pictured the scenes perfectly in my mind. I thought that name sounded, sounded familiar. Kathleen Kearney, surely, is the daughter from the previous story. Very interesting. Good pickup, Techrific. Swim said the Mama Fishy said, well, John Huston directed his last movie based on this story back in 1987. Huh. There you go. Might have to have a look at that. Swim said the Mama Fishy also said, the whole thing with the galoshes, he's being teased because they are all the thing on the continent. Gabriel is expanding his horizons and his family is making fun of him. I feel his pain. My family does this too. He doesn't want to be teased by using the Browning reference, so he is second-guessing himself. Also, he reviewed Browning's poems in the newspaper that Miss Ivers takes him to task with, and then she gives him grief for expanding his horizons past his own country, in front of people. And his mother gave him grief for settling for lower-class country cute, who took care of her in her last illness. which is one reason why he is reacting so negatively to Miss Ivor's suggestion. His dead mother would definitely not approve. Question 2. The party is set out at the beginning. It's the annual dance the ladies hold every year. Since they are all involved in music, it makes sense that Mary Jane plays a piece. What's interesting is the piece is very complex without a popular melody. She is apparently very talented. You would think that sophisticated Gabriel would appreciate it, but no, only he can be the complex one, and she doesn't care if no one gets it or not. And question 3. I think Joyce is neutral. He understands why Gabriel is expanding his horizons, but also Miss Ivor's nationalistic passion. Interesting about the complexity of the piece that Mary Jane is playing. You would think that sophisticated Gabriel would appreciate it. He can be the only complex one. Although he is sort of dumbing down his speech by removing the Browning reference. So maybe he's sort of thinking Mary Jane ought to have done the same thing, like play something a bit more of a crowd pleaser rather than a technical accomplishment. Swim said the mum fishy said, also, observation, I noticed the mentions of snow. I think that is important. He reacts negatively. His wife would walk home in it. Guanadal said, I think he is trying to show his family that he is educated but not snobby. He is having a hard time reading the room and feels like he said the wrong things to Lily. This strikes me as insecurity, since Lily's reaction to his question was bizarre and he didn't have the confidence to see that it was her conversational awkwardness and not his. He's a funny character. Sometimes he does seem insecure, and at other times he seems actually quite confident, like the fact that he smiles so often, and he also doesn't seem to react emotionally to anything. You know, when his aunt is having a bit of a dig at him, or he's kind of got his emotions in check, at least. He doesn't fly off the handle. He doesn't get defensive. I think there was one moment when he said something defensive and then kind of immediately noticed that he had. Interesting, kind of well-balanced in that way, I suppose. He's not all of one or the other. Guanadal also said, I think it is just an annual family tradition that they call a dance. It seemed more like a big dinner party with a bit of music and dancing than a full-on concert. Yeah, it was funny. At the start, the scene seemed like they were in some big concert hall with multiple rooms or something like that, and then as it went on, I kind of reassessed the scene in my head and think, oh, I actually think I've got this wrong. And the picture started to change more into like a big family, like a regatta sort of thing like that, with a bit of entertainment. It's not a real clear picture in my head at the moment. It's like a 50% picture of what's going on, setting-wise. Like, is there other people there apart from family? Is this a public space, or is it at someone's house? It's still a little bit foggy. Anyway, it's kind of coming into focus, though, as we read. Guanadal also said, she seemed almost like a caricature to me, referring to, what was her name? The lady that had a go at him? Miss Ivors, that was it. She seemed almost like a caricature to me. If her character was an American in 2019, she would be wearing an American flag hat, criticizing Gabriel for writing book reviews in Spanish and berating him for vacationing outside the US. I don't like her, and I think that was intentional on Joyce's part. I think that that would be quite a severe exaggeration of her character, because I know it does seem like she's being quite sort of xenophobic, but you've got to remember that the British were sort of colonizing. I've opened the Wikipedia here, so I can, well, read it from here rather than trying to put it in my own words. But essentially, Ireland became under England's control, and not all of Ireland was happy with that, and it took them a while to regain back their independence. And at the point of this story, they hadn't quite done that. Excuse my phone beeping there, right in the middle of a sentence. Just put that on silent. Should have done that already. So, this is what the Wikipedia says. War and colonization during the 16th and 17th centuries brought Ireland securely under English control. However, this was at a cost of great resentment over land ownership and inequitable laws. This resulted in Gaelic ties between Scotland and Ireland withering dramatically over the course of the 17th century, including a divergence in the Gaelic language into two distinct languages. Secret societies both opposing and supporting British rule through violent means developed in the 18th century, and several open rebellions were staged, most notably the 1798 rebellion. Although Ireland gained near independence from Great Britain in 1782, the kingdoms of Great Britain and Ireland were merged in 1801 to form the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. 19th century violent and constitutional campaigns for autonomy and independence culminated in an election in 1918, returning almost 70% of seats to Sinn Féin, who declared Irish independence from Britain and set up a parliament in Dublin, and declared the independence of Ireland from the United Kingdom. A war of independence followed that ended in the Anglo-Irish Treaty of 1922, which partitioned Ireland between the Irish Free State, which gained dominion status within the British Empire, and a devolved administration in Northern Ireland, which remained part of the UK. In 1937, Ireland declared itself fully independent of the United Kingdom. So you can see at the beginning of the 1900s, or the end of the 1800s, they still hadn't regained their independence, and there was a lot of contention around that. A lot of them didn't want to be colonised by England. And the fact that during that process they lost even their own language to the British. To the point where now in Ireland they predominantly speak English. You can see what it's. I think it's a bit different from what you've said there about them essentially just being sort of xenophobic and not wanting anyone from other countries to come to their country. I don't really think that's. I don't think it's exactly the same. I don't think they dislike other cultures or anything like that. I think they were just fighting to, because they were part of a unionization. The Commonwealth, whatever it's called, which they didn't really want to be part of. So you can see, yeah, you can understand that. The same thing happened with a lot of places that were taken under British rule and fought back for their independent status. India, for example, and others. Even in Australia now, they've every now and then they talk about, should we become an independent country? I kind of like being a Commonwealth country, but it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference, to be honest. But Australia was colonised by Europeans, so it doesn't make much difference here, whereas Ireland had their own traditions and their own heritage and language and everything before England colonised there. I don't know enough about the history of it, to be honest, to speak authoritatively about it. But I do think it's like I think it's just such a difficult thing, because if my language was disappearing from this country, then I would start to say like, oh, hang on a minute, like this is how we speak, right? And the language was one thing, but it was also like I don't know, like if language would be the most noticeable thing, but just the general way of the society as well. I don't know, we should talk more about that. We've got a couple of chapters left here to go, so it's a very interesting thing. Maybe, you know what I'll do? I'm going to get a good friend of mine, Robbie Verhagen, who writes historical fiction. He knows a lot about this, because his book he's writing now, I think I spoke to you guys already about this, is based back in when I was settling Australia, the convicts, but the three main characters from his story came from Ireland, and they're Protestants and Catholics, and one's a convict, and I don't know, he just knows a lot about that time and place. Now, I was going to get him to do the wrap-up episode of Dubliners. Unfortunately, he is away until later in the month because he's off doing a family, what was it, a Bucks holiday sort of thing or something like that. So it's going to be a bit of a wait on that, but I will still get him to come in and do it. It'll just be a bit of a throwback. So we'll do our own wrap-up, and then in a couple of weeks I'll do like a bonus episode where I get him in to speak about Dubliners and about Ireland in this time and place. Very cool. All right. I think that is going to do us for our chat about part one of The Dead, story 15. Let's move on and read the second part. It goes a little bit like this. When the lances were over, Gabriel went away to a remote corner of the room where Freddie Mallon's mother was sitting. She was a stout, feeble old woman with white hair. Her voice had a catch in it like her son's, and she stuttered slightly. She had been told that Freddie had come and that he was nearly all right. Gabriel asked her whether she had had a good crossing. She lived with her married daughter in Glasgow and came to Dublin on a visit once a year. She answered placidly that she had had a beautiful crossing and that the captain had been most attentive to her. She spoke also of the beautiful house her daughter kept in Glasgow and of all the friends they had there. While her tongue rambled on, Gabriel tried to banish from his mind all memory of the unpleasant incident with Miss Ivors. Of course, the girl, or woman, or whatever she was an enthusiast, but there was a time for all things. Perhaps he ought not to have answered her like that. But she had no right to call him a West Briton before people, even in joke. She had tried to make him ridiculous before people, heckling him and staring at him with her rabbit's eyes. He saw his wife making her way towards him through the waltzing couples. When she reached him, she said into his ear, "Gabriel, Aunt Kate wants to know, won't you carve the goose, as usual? Miss Daly will carve the ham, and I'll do the pudding." "All right," said Gabriel. "She's sending in the younger ones first, as soon as this waltz is over, so that we'll have the table to ourselves." "Were you dancing?" asked Gabriel. "Of course I was. Didn't you see me? What row had you with Molly Ivors?" "No row. Why, did she say so?" "Something like that. I'm trying to get that Mr. Darcy to sing. He's full of conceit, I think." "There was no row," said Gabriel moodily. "Only she wanted me to go for a trip to the west of Ireland, and I said I wouldn't." His wife clasped her hands excitedly and gave a little jump. "Oh, do go, Gabriel," she cried. "I'd love to see Galloway again." "You can go if you like," said Gabriel coldly. She looked at him for a moment, then turned to Mrs. Mallons and said, "There's a nice husband for you, Mrs. Mallons." While she was threading her way back across the room, Mrs. Mallons, without adverting to the interruption, went on to tell Gabriel what beautiful places there were in Scotland and beautiful scenery. Her son-in-law brought them every year to the lakes, and they used to go fishing. Her son-in-law was a splendid fisher. One day he caught a big, beautiful fish, and the man in the hotel cooked it for their dinner. Gabriel hardly heard what she said. Now that supper was coming near, he began to think about his speech and about the quotation. When he saw Freddie Mallons coming across the room to visit his mother, Gabriel left the chair free for him and retired into the embrasure of the window. The room had already cleared, and from the back room came the clatter of plates and knives. Those who still remained in the drawing room seemed tired of dancing and were conversing quietly in little groups. Gabriel's warm, trembling fingers tapped the cold pane of the window. How cool it must be outside. How pleasant it would be to walk out alone, first along by the river, and then through the park. The snow would be lying on the branches of the trees and forming a bright cap on the top of the Wellington Monument. How much more pleasant it would be there than at this supper table. He ran over the headings of his speech. Irish hospitality, sad memories, the three graces, Paris, the quotation from Browning. He repeated to himself a phrase he had written in his review. One feels that one is listening to a thought, tormented music. Miss Ivors had praised the review. Was she sincere? Had she really any life of her own behind all her propagandism? There had never been any ill feeling between them until that night. It unnerved him to think that she would be at the supper table looking at him while he spoke with her critical, quizzing eyes. Perhaps she would not be sorry to see him fail on his speech. An idea came into his mind and gave him courage. He would say, alluding to Aunt Kate and Aunt Julia, "Ladies and gentlemen, the generation which is now on the wane among us may have had its faults, but for my part I think it had a certain qualities of hospitality, of humour, of humanity, which the new and very serious and hyper-educated generation that is growing up around us seems to me to lack." Very good, that was one for Miss Ivors. What did he care that his aunts were only two ignorant old women? A murmur in the room attracted his attention. Mr. Brown was advancing from the door, gallantly escorting Aunt Julia, who leaned upon his arm, smiling and hanging her head. An irregular musketry of applause escorted her also as far as the piano, and then, as Mary Jane seated herself on the stool, and Aunt Julia, no longer smiling, half-turned so as to pitch her voice fairly into the room, gradually ceased. Gabriel recognized the prelude. It was that of an old song of Aunt Julia's, arrayed for the bridal. Her voice, strong and clear in tone, attacked with great spirit the runs which embellished the air, and though she sang very rapidly, she did not miss even the smallest of the grace notes. To follow the voice without looking at the singer's face was to feel and share the excitement of swift and secure flight. Gabriel applauded loudly with all the others at the close of the song, and loud applause was borne in from the invisible supper table. It sounded so genuine that a little colour struggled into Aunt Julia's face as she bent to replace in the music stand the old leather-bound songbook that had her initials on the cover. Freddie Mallins, who had listened in with his head perched sideways to hear her better, was still applauding when everyone else had ceased, and talked animatedly to his mother, who nodded her head gravely and slowly in acquiescence. At last, when he could clap no more, he stood up suddenly and hurried across the room to Aunt Julia, whose hand he seized and held in both hands, shaking it when words failed him. All the catch in his voice proved too much for him. "I was just telling my mother," he said. "I never heard you sing so well, never. No, I never heard your voice so good as it is tonight. Now, would you believe that now? That's the truth. Upon my word and honour, that's the truth. I never heard your voice sound so fresh and so clear and fresh, never." Aunt Julia smiled broadly and murmured something about compliments as she released her hand from his grasp. Mr. Brown extended his open hand towards her and said to those who were near him in the manner of a showman introducing a prodigy to an audience, "Miss Julia Morkan, my latest discovery." He was laughing very heartily at this himself when Freddie Mallins turned to him and said, "Well, Brown, if you're serious, you might make a worse discovery. All I can say is I never heard her sing half so well as long as I'm coming here. And that's the honest truth." "Neither did I," said Mr. Brown. "I think her voice has greatly improved." Aunt Julia shrugged her shoulders and said with meek pride, "30 years ago I hadn't a bad voice as voices go." "I often told Julia," said Aunt Kate emphatically, "that she was simply thrown away in that choir, but she never would be said by me." She turned as if to appeal to the good sense of the others against the refractory child, while Aunt Julia gazed in front of her, a vague smile of reminiscence playing on her face. "No," continued Aunt Kate, "she wouldn't be said or led by anyone slaving there in that choir night and day, 6 o'clock on Christmas morning, and all for what?" "Well, isn't it for the honour of God, Aunt Kate?" asked Mary Jane, twisting round on the piano stool and smiling. Aunt Kate turned fiercely on her niece and said, "I know all about the honour of God, Mary Jane, but I think it's not all honourable for the Pope to turn out the women out of the choirs that have slaved there all their lives and put little whippersnappers of boys over their heads. I suppose it is for the good of the church if the Pope does it, but it's not just, Mary Jane, and it's not right." She had worked herself into a passion, and would have continued in defence of her sister for it, for it was a sore subject with her, but Mary Jane, seeing that all the dancers had come back, intervened pacifically. "Now, Aunt Kate, you're giving me scandal to Mr. Brown, who is of the other persuasion." Aunt Kate turned to Mr. Brown, who was grinning at this allusion to his religion, and said hastily, "Oh, I don't question the Pope being right. I'm only a stupid old woman, and I wouldn't presume to do such a thing. But there's such a thing as common everyday politeness and gratitude. And if I were in Julia's place, I'd tell that Father Healy straight up to his face." "And besides, Aunt Kate," said Mary Jane, "we really are all hungry, and when we are hungry, we are all very quarrelsome." "And when we are thirsty, we are also quarrelsome," added Mr. Brown. "So that we had better go to supper," said Mary Jane, "and finish the discussion afterwards." On the landing outside the drawing-room, Gabriel found his wife and Mary Jane trying to persuade Miss Ivors to stay for supper, but Miss Ivors, who had put on her hat and was buttoning her cloak, would not stay. She did not feel in the least hungry, and she had already overstayed her time. "But only for 10 minutes, Molly," said Mrs. Conroy. "That won't delay you." "To take a pick itself," said Mary Jane, "after all your dancing." "I really couldn't," said Miss Ivors. "I'm afraid you didn't enjoy yourself at all," said Mary Jane hopelessly. "Ever so much, I assure you," said Miss Ivors, "but you really must let me run off now." "But how can you get home?" asked Mrs. Conroy. "Oh, it's only 2 steps up the quay." Gabriel hesitated a moment and said, "If you will allow me, Miss Ivors, I'll see you home if you are really obliged to go." But Miss Ivors broke away from them. "I won't hear of it," she cried. "For goodness sake, go into your suppers and don't mind me. I'm quite well able to take care of myself." "Well, you're the comical girl, Molly," said Mrs. Conroy frankly. "Benacht lip," cried Miss Ivors with a laugh, as she ran down the staircase. Mary Jane gazed after her, a moody, puzzled expression on her face, while Mrs. Conroy leaned over the banisters to listen for the hall door. Gabriel asked himself, was he the cause of her abrupt departure? But she did not seem to be in ill humour. She had gone away laughing. He stared blankly down the staircase. At the moment, Aunt Kate came toddling out of the supper room, almost wringing her hands in despair. "Where is Gabriel?" she cried. "Where on earth is Gabriel? There's everyone waiting in there, stage to let, and nobody to carve the goose." "Here I am, Aunt Kate," cried Gabriel with sudden animation, "ready to carve a flock of geese if necessary." A fat brown goose lay at one end of the table, and at the other end, on a bed of creased paper strewn with sprigs of parsley, lay a great ham, stripped of its outer skin and peppered all over with crust crumbs, a neat paper frill around its shin, and beside this was a round of spiced beef. Between the rival ends ran parallel lines of side dishes, 2 little minsters of jelly, red and yellow, a shallow dish full of blocks of blancmange and red jam, a large green leaf-shaped dish with a stalk-shaped handle, on which lay bunches of purple raisins and peeled almonds, a companion dish on which lay a solid rectangle of Smyrna figs, a dish of custard topped with grated nutmeg, a small bowl full of chocolates and sweets wrapped in gold and silver papers, and a glass vase in which stood some tall celery stalks. In the centre of the table there stood, as sentries to a fruit stand which upheld a pyramid of oranges and American apples, 2 squat, old-fashioned decanters of cut glass, one containing port and the other dark sherry. On the closed square piano, a pudding in a huge yellow dish lay in waiting, and behind it were 3 squads of bottles of stout and ale and minerals drawn up according to the colours of their uniforms. The 1st 2 black with brown and red labels, the 3rd and smallest squad white, with transverse green sachets. Gabriel took his seat boldly at the head of the table, and having looked to the edge of the carver, plunged his fork firmly into the goose. He felt quite at ease now, for he was an expert carver and liked nothing better than to find himself at the head of a well-laden table. "Miss Furlong, what shall I send you?" he asked. "A wing or a slice of breast?" "Just a small slice of the breast." "Miss Higgin, what for you?" "Oh, anything at all, Mr. Conroy." While Gabriel and Miss Daly exchanged plates of goose and plates of ham and spiced beef, Lily went from guest to guest with a dish of hot, floury potatoes wrapped in a white napkin. This was Mary Jane's idea, and she had also suggested applesauce for the goose, but Aunt Kate had said that plain roast goose without any applesauce had always been good enough for her, and she hoped she might never eat worse. Mary Jane waited on her pupils and saw that they got the best slices of, and Aunt Kate and Aunt Julia opened and carried across from the piano bottles of stout and ale for the gentlemen and bottles of minerals for the ladies. There was a great deal of confusion and laughter and noise, the noise of orders and counter-orders, of knives and forks, of corks and glass stoppers. Gabriel began to carve second helpings as soon as he had finished the first round without serving himself. Everyone protested loudly, so that he compromised by taking a long draught of stout, for he had found the carving hot work. Mary Jane settled down quietly to her supper, but Aunt Kate and Aunt Julia were still toddling around the table, walking on each other's heels, getting in each other's way, and giving each other unheeded orders. Mr. Brown begged of them to sit down and eat their suppers, and so did Gabriel, but they said there was time enough, so that at last Freddy Mellins stood up and, capturing Aunt Kate, plumped her down on her chair amid general laughter. When everyone had been well served, Gabriel said, smiling, "Now, if anyone wants a little more of what vulgar people call stuffing, let him or her speak." A chorus of voices invited him to begin his own supper, and Lily came forward with three potatoes which she had reserved for him. "Very well," said Gabriel, amiably, as he took another preparatory draught. "Kindly forget my existence, ladies and gentlemen, for a few minutes." He set to his supper and took no part in the conversation with which the table covered Lily's removal of the plates. The subject of talk was the opera company, which was then at the Theatre Royal. Mr. Bartell Darcy, the tenor, a dark-complexioned young man with a smart moustache, praised very highly the leading contralto of the company, but Miss Furlong thought she had a rather vulgar style of production. Freddy Mallins said there was a negro chieftain singing in the second part of the Gaiety pantomime, who had one of the finest tenors' voices who he had ever heard. "Have you heard of him?" he asked Mr. Bartell Darcy across the table. "No," answered Mr. Bartell Darcy carelessly. "Because," Freddy Mallins explained, "now I'd be curious to hear your opinion of him. I think he has a grand voice." "It takes Teddy to find out the really good things," said Mr. Brown familiarly to the table. "And why couldn't he have a voice too?" asked Freddy Mallins sharply. "Is it because he's only a black?" Nobody answered this question, and Mary Jane led the table back to the legitimate opera. One of her pupils had given her a pass for Mignon. Of course it was very fine, she said, but it made her think of poor George Burns. Mr. Brown could go back farther still to the old Italian companies that used to come to Dublin, Tietjens, Ilma, de Mersac, Campanini, the great Trebelli, Giolini, Ravelli, Arambudo. Those were the days, he said, when there was something like singing to be heard in Dublin. He told, too, of how the top gallery of the Royal used to be packed night after night, of how one night an Italian tenor had sung five encores to Let Me Like a Soldier Fall, introducing a high C every time, and of how the gallery boys would sometimes, in their enthusiasm, unyoke the horses from the carriage of some great prima donna, and pull her themselves through the street to her hotel. "Why did they never play the grand old operas now?" he asked. "Dinora, Lusrizia, Borgia." "Because they could not get the voices to sing them, that was why." "Oh well," said Mr. Bartell Darcy, "I presume there are as good singers today as there were then." "Where are they?" asked Mr. Brown defiantly. "In London, Paris, Milan," said Mr. Bartell Darcy warmly. "I suppose Caruso, for example, is quite as good, if not better, than any of the men you have mentioned. Maybe so, said Mr. Brown, but I may tell you I doubt it strongly. Oh, I'd give anything to hear Caruso sing, said Mary Jane. For me, said Aunt Kate, who had been picking a bone, there was only one tenor. To please me, I mean, but I suppose none of you ever heard of him. Who was he, Miss Morkan? Asked Mr. Bartell Darcy politely. His name, said Aunt Kate, was Mr. Parkinson. I heard him when he was in his prime, and I think he had then the purest tenor voice that was ever put in a man's throat. Strange, said Mr. Bartell Darcy, I've never heard of him. Yes, yes, Miss Morkan is right, said Mr. Brown. I remember hearing of old Parkinson, but he's too far back for me. A beautiful, pure, sweet, mellow English tenor, said Aunt Kate with enthusiasm. Gabriel, having finished, the huge pudding was transferred to the table. The clatter of forks and spoons began again. Gabriel's wife served out spoonfuls of the pudding and passed the plates down the table. Midway down they were held up by Mary Jane, who replenished them with raspberry or orange jelly, or with blanc mange, and jam. The pudding was of Aunt Julia's making, and she received praise for it from all quarters. She herself said it was not quite brown enough. "Well, I hope, Miss Morkan," said Miss Brown, "that I'm brown enough for you, because, you know, I'm all brown." All the gentlemen except Gabriel ate some of the pudding out of compliment to Aunt Julia. As Gabriel never ate sweets, the celery had been left for him. Freddy Mellins also took a stalk of celery and ate it with his pudding. He had been told that celery was a capital thing for the blood, and he was just then under doctor's care. Miss Mellins, who had been silent all through the supper, said that her son was going down to Mount Mellaray in a week or so. The table then spoke of Mount Mellaray, how bracing the air was down there, how hospitable the monks were, and how they never asked for a penny piece. "And do you mean to say," asked Miss Brown incredulously, "that a chap can go down there and put up there as if it were a hotel and live on the fat of the land and then come away without paying anything?" "Oh, most people give some donation to the monastery when they leave," said Mary Jane. "I wish we had an institution like that in our church," said Mr. Brown candidly. He was astonished to hear that the monks never spoke, got up at 2 a.m. and slept in their coffins. He asked what they did it for. "That's the rule of the order," said Aunt Kate firmly. "Yes, but why?" asked Mr. Brown. Aunt Kate repeated that it was the rule, that was all. Mr. Brown still seemed not to understand. Freddy Mellins explained to him as best he could that the monks were trying to make up for the sins committed by all the sinners in the outside world. The explanation was not very clear for Mr. Brown, for Mr. Brown grinned and said, "I like that idea very much, but wouldn't a comfortable spring bed do them as well as a coffin?" "The coffin," said Mary Jane, "is to remind them of their last end." As the subject had grown lugubrious, it was buried in a silence of the table, during which Miss Mellins could be heard saying to her neighbour in an indistinct undertone, "They are very good men, the monks, very pious men." All right, I'm going to pause it there for today's part of this chapter. Have your say about part 2 of The Dead at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I'll just say a quick reminder about the Patreon page, patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. If you would like to support the creation of this podcast, you can do so for $1. $1 per month. You can subscribe for as long as you like or as short as you like. And that helps me produce this podcast and allows me to spend time making it. Donations pay monthly, so you can subscribe for $1 a month or $2 or $5 or whatever you think 1 month's worth of podcasts is worth to you. You can also cancel it at any time or change the amount or do whatever you want. I do thank you for considering that. I've also been doing a strange thing. I've been translating chapters of War and Peace into Bogan Australian. I've only done a couple, but I'm posting all of them over on the Patreon page. You can actually view them for free. You don't have to be a subscriber to view them. So if you want to see that, go to patreon.com/thehemingwaylist and click on posts, and you'll be able to see the couple of chapters that I've translated. You might find that interesting. You might not. Something you can check out, though, in the meantime. That's going to do us for today. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.